Hello, everybody. My name is Belle Rajewski-Samko, and welcome to my podcast. So, in this podcast episode, I'm going to be talking about immigration and the experiences of immigrants, migrants, and refugees. So first, I'm going to start talking about what's going on in the media and the rhetoric that we see, along with delving into some of the statistics about what's going on specifically at our southern border. And then I'm going to actually delve into one of my favorite novels, which is a book that's all about the different experiences of African immigrants in Europe. And it's based on around the author's true experiences meeting all these people, but it is still considered a novel because there is aspects of fiction woven into it. So I'm going to talk about that. And then I am going to speak a bit about the things that we've been learning in class. So, you know, assimilation, accommodation, separation. I'm going to talk about culture shock and all of that. And then I will conclude with an interview from my father, who escaped communist Poland when he was only 18 years old, and he immigrated to Canada. So that's more coming right up. So I'm going to assume that nobody listening lives under a rock, and especially you, Professor Dabinga, I know you don't. So I'm going to be talking about the rhetoric from Donald Trump. And I just want to point out, we all know his feelings about immigrants, and we all know the things that he's been saying about specifically Mexican immigrants and the caravan that was moving up through South America. So I just wanted to delve into some of his most famous tweets regarding those issues to talk about, because this is an intercultural communications class, so I'd like to bring this into it. So first one, we have, quote, "To those in the caravan, turn around. We are not letting people into the United States illegally. Go back to your country. And if you want, apply for citizenship like millions of others are doing," end quote. I'd also like to note that country is capitalized, so that's a little interesting thing. Another one he has written, quote, "Many gang members," also capitalized, "and some very bad people are mixed into the caravan heading to our southern border. Please go back. You will not be admitted into the United States unless you go through the legal process. This is an invasion of our country, and our military is waiting for you," end quote. I just also wanted to speak about his word invasion that he uses, because in this other one that I'm also looking at, I won't read the whole thing, but basically he starts off saying, quote, "We cannot allow all of these people to invade our country." This word invade is really interesting because, you know, we could have chosen any other word, but that word kind of assumes that we are under attack. And I think that is the word, we've talked about him being a whistleblower, that riles people up, this word invade, because it feels like we need to protect and they're going to do harm. And so that was really interesting to me, that when I kept looking through his tweets, that word constantly came up, that he chose specifically, you know, this to convey something. And that's what communication is, but it's very calculated. USA Today actually conducted an analysis of the transcripts from more than 6 of Donald Trump's rallies, campaign rallies, that discuss immigration. And the results proved that together he's used the words predator, invasion, alien, killer, criminal, and animal at his rallies while discussing immigration more than 500 times. And also, it had found that he uses the word invasion at least 19 times out of 64 rallies. He used the word animal 34 times and the word killer nearly 36 times. He has also said, quote, "The hell out of our country," end quote, at least 43 times during his rallies. And obviously, in all of those cases, he was referring to immigrants in the country illegally. And a professor, Ruth Ben-Giat, who is a history professor at NYU, he explained, he studies propaganda, that Trump does nothing by accident. And he says, quote, "The use of repetition, a propaganda mainstay, points to an intention by Trump to impose a way of thinking about his designed targets," end quote. And we do talk about that in class and discuss that. And I know that you're saying, Professor Dabinga, saying that, you know, people always say that Trump is stupid and he's whatever, he doesn't understand, he's dumb. But he's actually quite smart because he knows what he's doing. And when you said that, that resonated with me because it's changed my way and how I've thought about things, because he really does know what he's doing in terms of riling up his supporters and the rhetoric that he uses and the words that he uses to choose to communicate. continuing on the theme of Donald Trump, I have a few graphs from the Pew Research Center that I thought were really interesting that speak about the changes that have happened within immigration since Donald Trump became president. So we look in 2017, there's this graph that shows that more Christians than Muslims have entered the United States as refugees. And it shows specifically, it's marked by color, so it's really easy to see. But as the years go on, you know, it's pretty, I'd say around equal for amount of Muslim refugees and amount of Christian refugees. And as the years go on, it gets like larger and larger for the Christian refugees. And we look in 2016, it's about equal. And then as the years go down, 2018, there was just a small number of Muslim refugees and a huge number of Christian refugees. And then it continued to build in 2019. I'm also looking at another chart about the shifting origins of refugees to the United States, and it shows it since 1975. So it breaks it down by color depending on the different continents. So it has Europe, Asia, Latin America, and Africa. And what I found really interesting was looking specifically towards the latter years during Trump's administration. You know, I was looking at about 2017, 2018, 2019. We look, and the color for Latin America is a maroon color. There's barely any maroon. It's barely visible. And it's largely taken up by the green color, which represents Asia, and a small bit of Europe. But it's just the years before that, you can clearly see the maroon color for Latin America. And it becomes so small, it's like a sliver for 2018 and 2019. Personally, I understand better and learn better when I can hear the experiences of people, opposed to simply reading statistics or reading the news. I really understand the severity of the issue and what's going on if I hear about people's stories. So for that reason, I would like to compare and contrast and examine immigrants, migrants, and refugees' different experiences and hear their stories. And one of my favorite books, Travelers by Helen Habila, does exactly this. It is all about the stories of African immigrants and migrants in Europe. And each chapter alternates between the narrator and then a different person that the narrator meets. And these stories in this book just really portrayed the raw emotion of people's experiences. And I really love that and reading that, because I feel like it just brings the severity of the issue up front and you understand it better. And so when I was reading this book, specifically this concept of loneliness within immigrants were stuck out to me. And I realized that it's something we really don't talk about. People often forget about it, and I think it's an issue that's severely neglected, because so many immigrants went from a world filled with neighbors and family and a strong support system, a big group of people that they were connected to most of the time. And when they immigrate for whatever reason, or, you know, have to leave their country, they arrive to a world filled with nameless neighbors and uninterested coworkers generally. You know, people don't understand them, don't care for them. It's just such a flop from the original circumstances that the person had. And I mean, of course, this isn't the case with every immigrant. There are many happy endings and many people that are happy where they are. And my dad is one of them that you'll hear from later. But nonetheless, the journey is a difficult one. And normally we only hear about the hardships immigrants faced in their home countries. And I'm not negating the importance of those narratives. Of course, those are important. But I would really like to explore the lonely reality of immigrants in their new countries and how the day-to-day is for that and what their feelings are of that. Because this idea that's a constant longing to be home and reunited with loved ones but unable to do so is very tragic. And I'm just interested in how people cope with that and how they feel about it. In a 2014 survey of immigrants in London, 58% said that loneliness was their most pressing problem. Another survey done by InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, an organization that works with international students specifically, said that 70% of immigrants never set foot inside an American home, and only 40% have any significant relationships with Americans. There are so many reasons why immigrants and refugee populations experience such high levels of social isolation,
I mean, you have the experience of some people have being ripped away from their world and dropped into another and being the minority when they were once the majority. You have to learn to relive a completely new life in a different way. And also, on top of that, refugees, by definition, have to experience great trauma generally. And that in itself can lead to various forms of mental health issues like depression or PTSD. And then when you add this isolation and add a rising hostility against immigrants, especially Muslim immigrants or immigrants of color, the alienation is just incredible. And it is no wonder that these extreme levels of loneliness are felt. So, I am going to be specifically looking at Manu as a character from Travelers and looking at his section in his experience as being an immigrant in a different place. And specifically, I wanted to look at his dedication to going to Checkpoint Charlie's, his unwavering dedication that every Sunday him and his daughter go to try to find his wife and his son who they've been separated. And I just thought that this one specific section of the book, it's when he is going with his daughter and they thought that they saw Basma, his wife, in the crowd, and they realized that it wasn't her. And they just found this woman and were yelling to get her attention, and then they realized it wasn't her. And he says, passerbys looked casually at them and he wondered what they saw. A tired-looking man and a crying girl by the roadside, clearly foreigners, in their old and ill-fitting winter jackets. Mostly, though, they didn't see you at all. And I just thought that that passage completely demonstrated this idea that I was just talking about previously of people being completely lonely and, you know, having uninterested new people that they have no idea in these new places that they immigrated to, and the heartbreak in that. And you have versions of stories that these people, you know, his experience has been so, despite moving to have better opportunities, you know, and being in a more stable living situation, you have to deal with these complex emotions that are attached to it. Because a lot of people, I think this is also the issue of people who are really anti-immigration, don't understand that no one wants to leave their home. No one wants to be forced to leave their home, you know? And so people don't immigrate and become migrants or refugees because they just feel like it. They're forced into doing it. And I just think that that passage specifically just shows, like, they didn't even see you at all, you know, that of feeling invisible, but knowing you don't feel like you don't belong there. And it's just, you have experiences like that. And then in a bit, I will interview my father, whose experience is completely, completely different than, you know, Manu's within this section. So when you look at the opposite side of Manu in this book, there is another character who was the daughter of somebody in the book. And the daughter begins telling the story that her father was exposing the government where they were originally from of corruption. And he was forced to go into exile in England. And so he went there with his daughter and with his wife. But after a while, when the wife and the daughter wanted to go back to their original country and it was safe for him to do so, he didn't want to. And he preferred to stay in exile because he enjoyed his life there and he developed friends. And she says that he always had writers and poets coming in and out of the house, keeping him company and throwing parties. And it is written that he, quote, developed a taste for exile, end quote. So we also have that difference between the stories of even just in a book, you know, when we have some people who are longing to be back with the people that they love, that they are with, when they were with them, they feel at home. But then with Portia's father, it's he doesn't want to be with them and he's happy in his new place. So I just thought that that was even just interesting within the book. You can see all the different experiences and stories. It doesn't just stick to one narrative of being more saddened and upset and in like a negative emotional aspect, but it shows that the duality of it in everybody's different experiences. I would like to bring in some of the terms and concepts that we've discussed in class to better
help explain this whole idea of immigrants and their journeys and their experiences and the day-to-day things that people go through. So first, I'd just like to identify what cultural adaptation is. So it is the long-term process of adjusting to and feeling comfortable in a new environment. So for cultural adaptation, there's really no definite adaptation period, and there's different factors that, you know, play into cultural adaptation, the environment that somebody moves into, the length of time that they spend there, and that can all impact the stages of adjustment and how long this adaptation is going to take. So something that relates specifically to this cultural adaptation is the U-curve of cross-cultural adaptation. So this model is a theory that migrants go through fairly predictable phases that goes up and down and up and down, that kind of tracks their emotions and their highs and lows. And so, you know, for example, there's excitement, then there's disorientation. So I just like to walk through that a little bit. So this curve, it's all based on the emotional well-being of someone and kind of broken up into different times of the arrival abroad and then the return home that somebody experiences. So there's, of course, the pre-departure ups and downs. There's the honeymoon phase that peaks and then it goes low again. That's the culture shock and acute homesickness. Then there's a period of adaptation and then it repeats for the return home. There's the up and downs and there's the excitement of returning home and seeing family and seeing life as it used to be. And then when somebody is often adapted to the culture, they will go down and miss the other culture. And that is reverse culture shock. So first, regular culture shock is personal disorientation that somebody is going to feel when they're experiencing an unfamiliar culture or way of life. And the reverse culture shock is that disorientation that the person feels once they return to their home culture. And it happens because people have adjusted to the new culture that they're in for so long that it becomes jarring when they have to go back to the one that they were born into and that they've grown up in and they're used to originally. And so I looked at a study done by the journal The Gerontologist, and it was a case study with with immigrants in the Netherlands and like their native counterparts. And so the results showed that migrants, as compared to natives, are both more emotionally and socially lonely, which isn't a surprise. But while 13% of the native population is severely lonely, this percentage for severely lonely migrants is 22.1%. So that's a very significant jump, you know, and that is severely lonely. And also, you need to factor that in that, you know, that number differs too, depending on where people are. And so I think that also part of the pre-departure up and down honeymoon phase may be anticipating, if they're immigrating to the United States, is what I'm talking about in this circumstance. You know, this part of it might be anticipating the American dream and thinking about all these opportunities and taking advantage of them and becoming successful. So I recently watched a documentary for my Spanish class on Cuban immigrants arriving to the U.S. by rafts, and it followed their experiences before when they were in Cuba, like preparing to immigrate, and then also, you know, when they were on their rafts, and then also once they were in the United States, and followed them for a few years afterwards. And before they were interviewed, they were so hopeful and excited to leave Cuba. But as the documentary followed them, they began understanding the difficulty and the hardshipness and, you know, missing their family. And that would be, if you look at this cross-cultural U-curve, that would be the culture shock and the homesickness part. Cultural adaptation can take so much longer, especially when one goes from a large power distance circumstance to a small power distance or vice versa, because large power distance we have defined in class, you know, as children are obedient and the elders are respected and feared. There's normally income inequality and corruptions and scandals and authoritarian governments. And then the small power distance is that children are normally treated as equals and the elders aren't necessarily respected or feared. It's like a student-centered education. There's normally less corruption and peaceful reform and less of also a religious, you know, stronghold. And so those are just completely different circumstances. And to put yourself in the shoes, I'm not an immigrant and I just cannot imagine, you know, going from one of those to the other situation just so quickly and having to learn all these new cultural differences and learn all of the, you know, hidden subcontexts of the things that you're just supposed to know if you were born there natively. Coming right up, you'll hear from my father, Frank Samko, as he talks about his experience escaping Poland when the country was under Soviet occupation at just 18 years old. He reflects on his time in an Austrian refugee camp and discusses the relative ease he had immigrating to Canada. You'll also find out that he really wasn't quite lonely. More coming up, so tune in. Okay, so I am here with my dad, Frank, and my dad...
Hi, everyone.
He left Poland when he was 18 years old, when Poland was a Soviet Union satellite state. And a satellite state is basically a country that was formally independent, but now it is under heavy political, economic, and military influence or control from another country. So I'm going to be asking him a few questions about his experience and his story as an immigrant. And he first immigrated to Canada and then into the United States afterwards. Just to clarify so people understand. So my dad was born in Poland, and then at 6 years old, they moved to the Soviet Union. And then when he was 12, they moved back to Poland.
Yes, well, I grew up in Soviet Union. I was only six at the time when I arrived to Soviet Union. And I was heavily, heavily influenced by Soviet propaganda. So I grew up as your Soviet Union citizen, which is a very unique type of a human being, was completely, totally brainwashed by the system. Then we went back to Poland and things changed drastically. At the time, all the communist countries were falling apart. The quality of life was, I guess, horrible. There were shortages of food, there were shortages of basic anything. And then the persecution of state was getting worse and worse and worse. And I guess I'm fortunate enough that I really never cared in my life for wealth and that sort of a thing. So it didn't really matter for me. And as life is sometimes, the more you are brainwashed by a system, if you are smart enough, intelligent enough, then at some point in your life, you will realize that, oh my God, I have lived through the worst of the worst. So at the age of 16, 17, when I started thinking for myself, it turned out that Soviet Union is not the greatest country in the world, that they are not the most wonderful place to ever be. So at that point, I already started thinking about maybe I should live somewhere else.
So was it you that started having the idea? Because you left with two of your brothers.
Yes. Well, I have two of my brothers. So there's only a very few years difference between us. We're pretty much the same age. So all of us started kind of thinking about that. And we thought this for certain there must be a better life somewhere than in these places. And we also thought, we were certain of it, that the communists in all those countries will be there forever.
That's interesting. Was there a specific, how long had you planned to leave? And why did you plan to leave at the age that you did and where you were?
Excuse me. Well, I don't remember how long we planned, but it wasn't an overnight thing. Mm-hmm. It required planning, but also it required certain courage, because no person, no matter how brave you are or curious about seeing other places on this planet, it's going to make that decision lightly because you leave everything behind you. It has taken years, I would imagine, to do that.
And so could you just speak on a little bit how you left? Because I know you left in the middle of the night, correct? And there was, I just would like you to share that kind of journey that you had.
Okay, well, it is kind of not really complicated, but within these satellite states, there were this unwritten rule. All these states, like Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Poland, Romania, all of them were falling apart. And the corruption had a completely different meaning what it is from today. I mean, And dishonesty in all these countries, that kind of system, communist system, is just perfect for dishonesty and corruption. And with a few dollars, you could bribe anyone, because people had such horrible lives that any amount of dollars, especially American dollars, would just open up these huge gates. Hmm. So if you had to cross a border from one country to another, and you know the citizen of that country, these people didn't care. Just give them a bottle of whiskey, give them a few dollars, give them a couple of packages of American cigarettes, and then you can go. But anyway, so we went through different borders of different communist countries, and we would bribe few guards, I suppose, and they would let us go. Of course, we were scared, all of us. We were just a young, sort of an innocent young boys, imagine of your age, if you're listening, if you're in your 20s or something like that. And then trying to find, being uncertain, being sure that if we get caught, you will end up in prison. You may end up in prison in Soviet Union, and all your life would be completely wasted.
Mm.
But we were fortunate and lucky enough to get to Austrian border, where we asked for political asylum.
My father and his brothers were granted political asylum at a refugee camp near Vienna in Austria. My dad has very fond memories of the refugee camp. It was very safe, very clean, and the staff were very kind. They were given 3 meals a day, a small stipend, and foreign language classes were available to all the refugees. If you wanted to work, the refugee camp staff helped find you a job too. So my dad was hired by a company that set up tents for events. So this way he was able to travel all around Europe, which was really eye-opening for someone who had spent their life behind the Iron Curtain. After spending about a year in the refugee camp, my father and his brothers immigrated to Canada with the help of Amnesty International. They were in a bright new place in a completely new country, and I wanted to ask my dad how him and his brothers adapted to their new culture that they were in. I asked him if he was lonely, because I do know that when he left Poland, he wasn't allowed to tell his sisters or his parents that they were leaving because they didn't want the authorities to harass them, and it was just safer if they had no idea. His response was as follows.
Well, I love to be alone, but the notion of loneliness is kind of foreign to me. I have never felt lonely in my life, but I get to stress that I love to be alone. So that part of emigrating really didn't bother me. It was too interesting, too fascinating. Everything was brand new. I was a very young man, and I was very optimistic about the future. So that wasn't a problem. And also, it was, I would say, important that we don't stay in touch with our parents, that they don't know where we are, because they may have a, they might be persecuted by the authorities. At that time, that the whole system was just an awful, awful, awful system. I think I'm very fortunate that the time that I emigrated, the world was pretty different from what it is today. My emigration seemed like such a smooth transition without really any headaches. These international organizations would help you. They would provide for you. And for example, I went to the same refugee camp 40 years ago that I was in 40 years ago. I went recently to that refugee camp, and I was actually shocked when I saw it. It was a very depressing sight to me. Absolute majority of people that were there were from Arab countries, and it was nothing like I remember what it was. And then also when I see immigrants that trying to get into the United States from Mexico border, it breaks my heart, because all these people are just regular people like myself, like any one of us, and they just would like to have a better life. Or for whatever reason, they like to emigrate, and that is not available for them. And the suffering that they have to
endure,
it's nothing like what I had.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very grateful for what I had. And it's a short period of time, but yet such tremendous differences.
Mm.
And I don't know what would I say if I had to deal with being hungry, being locked up, being look upon my as some kind of a criminal or evil person. So unfortunately, the world has changed drastically in that respect.
And it's really disgusting, too, to look at how differently the West in general, you know, European countries, United States, Canada, look at immigrants that are from, you know, European countries coming into the United States. You know, our president doesn't, you know, doesn't care if we have, you know, whatever, Italian immigrants or, you know, whatever, British immigrants. But as soon as it's a person of color or somebody from African immigrants or from Central America, the treatment is completely different.
Yes, and that is completely disgusting. And I would hope that it may change someday, because every single person that lives in America is an immigrant without an exception. At some point in history, everybody came to this country with their hopes and dreams. And why should it be different now? But unfortunately, it is.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Lastly, I'm going to leave you with a quote from Helen Habila. Reflecting on his process of writing The Travelers, he said, quote, "It's important to see the migrants as individuals. Everyone sees them as a menace or as a statistic. Nobody even sees them. For my subjects, for them to tell their story and to be listened to, I could see their satisfaction. Somebody is seeing me. I am not just a migrant. I am a father. I have a wife. I have a life. I am this person. But you don't know why they're coming to Europe. You don't know why they gave up their homes, their dreams, their lives. Some of them were actually happy back home, but sometimes you have to leave home." End quote.
Thank you so much for coming to my podcast and giving me a listen. Just to recap, today we talked about the rhetoric that Donald Trump has been using to describe immigrants, migrants, and refugees. We looked at some data and statistics. I delved into my favorite book, Travelers by Helen Habila, and gave some different examples of different experiences of immigrants in the novel. And we also heard an interview from my dad, who talked about his experience as an immigrant, first in Canada and then the United States. I really thank you for coming, and I hope you enjoyed it.